With a little imagination, Commander Norton told himself, he could pretend that this was an improvised night camp at the foot of some mountain in a remote region of Asia or America. The clutter of sleeping pads, collapsible chairs and tables, portable power plant, lighting equipment, electrosand toilets, and miscellaneous scientific apparatus would not have looked out of place on Earth, especially as there were men and women working here without life support systems. Establishing Camp Alpha had been very hard work, for everything had had to be manhandled through the chain of airlocks, sledded down the slope from the hub, and then retrieved and unpacked. Sometimes, when the braking parachutes had failed, a consignment had ended up a good kilometer away out on the plain. Despite this, several crew members had asked permission to make the ride. Norton had firmly forbidden it. In an emergency, however, he might be prepared to reconsider the ban. Almost all this equipment would stay here, for the labor of carrying it back was unthinkable, in fact, impossible. There were times when Commander Norton felt an irrational shame at leaving so much human litter in this strangely immaculate place. When they finally departed, he was prepared to sacrifice some of their precious time to leave everything in good order. Improbable though it was, perhaps millions of years hence, when Rama shot through some other star system, it might have visitors again. He would like to give them a good impression of Earth. Meanwhile, he had a rather more immediate problem. During the last 24 hours, he had received almost identical messages from both Mars and Earth. It seemed an odd coincidence. Perhaps they had been commiserating with each other, as wives who lived safely on different planets were liable to do under sufficient provocation. Rather pointedly, they had reminded him that even though he was now a great hero, he still had family responsibilities. The commander picked up a collapsible chair and walked out of the pool of light into the darkness surrounding the camp. It was the only way he could get any privacy, and he could also think better away from the turmoil. Deliberately turning his back on the organized confusion behind him, he began to speak into the recorder slung around his neck.
Original for personal file. Dupes to Mars and Earth. Hello, darling. Yes, I know I've been a lousy correspondent, but I haven't been aboard ship for a week. Apart from a skeleton crew, we're all camping inside Rama at the foot of the stairway we've christened Alpha. I have three parties out now, scouting the plane, but we've made disappointingly slow progress because everything has to be done on foot. If only we had some means of transport. I'd be very happy to settle for a few electric bicycles. They'd be perfect for the job. You've met my medical officer, Surgeon Commander Ernst. He paused uncertainly. Laura had met one of his wives, but which? Better cut that out. Erasing the sentence, he began again. My M.O., Surgeon Commander Ernst, led the first group to reach the cylindrical sea, 15 kilometers from here. She found that it was frozen water, as we'd expected, but you wouldn't want to drink it. Dr. Ernst says it's a dilute organic soup containing traces of almost any carbon compound you care to name, as well as phosphates and nitrates and dozens of metallic salts. There's not the slightest sign of life, not even any dead microorganisms. So we still know nothing about the biochemistry of the Ramans, though it was probably not wildly different from ours. Something brushed lightly against his hair. He had been too busy to get it cut, and would have to do something about that before he next put on a space helmet. You've seen the vidies of Paris and the other towns we've explored on this side of the sea. London, Rome, Moscow. It's impossible to believe that they were ever built for anything to live in. Paris looks like a giant storage depot. London is a collection of cylinders linked together by pipes connected to what are obviously pumping stations. Everything is sealed up, and there's no way of finding what's inside without explosives or lasers. We won't try these until there are no alternatives. As for Rome and Moscow... Excuse me, Skipper. Priority from Earth. What now? Norton asked himself. Can't a man get a few minutes to talk to his families?
He took the message from the sergeant and scanned it quickly, just to satisfy himself that it was not immediate. Then he read it again, more slowly. What the devil was the Rama Committee? And why had he never heard of it? He knew that all sorts of associations, societies, and professional groups, some serious, some completely crackpot, had been trying to get in touch with him. Mission Control had done a good job of protection and would not have forwarded this message unless it was considered important. 200 kilometer winds. Probably sudden onset. Well, that was something to think about. But it was hard to take too seriously on this utterly calm night, and it would be ridiculous to run away like frightened mice when they were just starting effective exploration. Commander Norton lifted a hand to brush aside his hair, which had somehow fallen into his eyes again. Then he froze, the gesture uncompleted. He had felt a trace of wind several times in the last hour. It was so slight that he had completely ignored it. After all, he was the commander of a spaceship, not a sailing ship. Until now, the movement of air had not been of the slightest professional concern. What would the long-dead captain of that earlier endeavor have done in a situation such as this? Norton had asked himself that question at every moment of crisis in the last few years. It was his secret, which he had never revealed to anyone. And like most of the important things in life, it had come about quite by accident. He had been captain of Endeavour for several months before he realized that it was named after one of the most famous ships in history. True, during the last 400 years, there had been a dozen Endeavours of sea and two of space, but the ancestor of them all was the 370-ton Whitby Collier that Captain James Cook, R.N., had sailed round the world between 1768 and 1771. With a mild interest that had quickly turned to an absorbing curiosity, almost an obsession, Norton had begun to read everything he could find about Cook. He was now probably the world's leading authority on the greatest explorer of all time, and knew whole sections of the journals by heart. It still seemed incredible that one man could have done so much with such primitive equipment, but Cook had been not only a supreme navigator, but a scientist, and, in an age of brutal discipline, a humanitarian. He treated his own men with kindness, which was unusual. What was quite unheard of was that he behaved in exactly the same way to the often hostile savages in the new lands he discovered. It was Norton's private dream, which he knew he would never achieve, to retrace at least one of Cook's voyages around the world. He had made a limited but spectacular start, which would certainly have astonished the captain, when he flew a polar orbit directly above the Great Barrier Reef. It had been early morning on a clear day, and from 400 kilometers up, he had had a superb view of that deadly wall of coral, marked by its line of white foam along the Queensland coast. He had taken just under 5 minutes to travel the whole 2,000 kilometers of the reef. In a single glance, he could span weeks of perilous voyaging for that first endeavor. And through the telescope, he had caught a glimpse of Cooktown and the estuary where the ship had been dragged ashore for repairs after her near-fatal encounter with the reef. A year later, a visit to the Hawaii Deep Space Tracking Station had given him an even more unforgettable experience. He had taken the hydrofoil to Kealakekua Bay, and as he moved swiftly past the bleak volcanic cliffs, he felt a depth of emotion that had surprised and even disconcerted him. The guide had led his group of scientists, engineers, and astronauts past the glittering metal pylon that had replaced the earlier monument destroyed by the great tsunami of 68. They had walked on for a few more yards across black, slippery lava to the small plaque at the water's edge. Little waves were breaking over it, but Norton scarcely noticed them as he bent down to read the words. "Near this spot, Captain James Cook was killed, 14th February, 1779. Original tablet dedicated 28th August, 1928, by Cook Sesquicentennial Commission. Replaced by Tricentennial Commission, 14th February, 2079. That was years ago, and 100 million kilometers away. But at moments like this, Cook's reassuring presence seemed very close. In the secret depths of his mind, he would ask, "Well, Captain, what is your advice?" It was a little game he played, on occasions when there were not enough facts for sound judgment, and one had to rely on intuition. That had been part of Cook's genius. He had always made the right choice, until the very end, at Kealakekua Bay. The sergeant waited patiently while his commander stared silently out into the night of Rama. It was no longer unbroken, for at two spots about 4 kilometers away, the faint patches of light of exploring parties could be clearly seen.